Welcome to the Water Resources Podcast. I am Bridget Scanlon. In this podcast, we discuss water challenges with leading experts, including topics on extreme climate events, overexploitation, and potential solutions towards more sustainable management. I'm pleased to welcome Randy Henson to the Water Resources Podcast. Randy is currently president of One Water Hydrologic, and he founded this company. And prior to that, Randy worked at the U.S. Geological Survey for 38 years, developing hydrologic methods and water supply analysis of regional watersheds nationally and internationally. So thank you so much, Randy, for joining me today.
Well, thanks so much for having me, and hopefully we can cover a few interesting things today.
Right. So when we chatted before, we thought we would start with the Rio Conchos, and because there's a lot of interest in the Mexico-US treaty and delivery of water and things like that. And Randy has done quite a bit of work on the Rio Conchos, which is a tributary of the Rio Grande, about 75,000 square kilometers. So, and then Randy will also talk a little bit about his methodologies, and he was a big contributor to ModFlow and developing the One Water, focusing on conjunctive use of surface water and groundwater, and I hope we will learn more about that. And if we have time, then we can talk a little bit about the Colorado. But Randy is based in San Diego, so he knows a lot about the California water issues. And I see a lot of parallels with the Rio Conchos, many of the issues that you have in the Central Valley. So I think we'll have some overlap there also, Randy. So maybe we can start with the Rio Conchos analysis, and one of your papers titled Capturing Wetness for Sustainability from Climate Variability and Change in the Rio Conchos, Chihuahua, Mexico. So mostly these days, people often talk about drought and drought impacts on water resources. But here you're focusing on trying to capture the water from wet periods and managing that. And of course, Mexico not meeting their treaty, the deliveries they're required for treaty with the U.S. Maybe you can describe that a little bit also, Randy.
Be happy to. What we ended up doing with my colleagues, in particular Dr. Marucia Renteria Villalobos at the Autonomous University of Chihuahua, we decided that we would try to take a look at really what's going on in the Rio Conchos. And it turns out, based on input I've had from other hydrologists in the area, that even though the treaty was developed, there really wasn't any follow-up or substantial information that looked at analyzing what the cycles of drought and whether any of these extreme events that have been occurring for decades were ever being accounted for in any way. What's ironic is that there are actually two treaties. So there's the Treaty of 1906, and that governs the delivery of water by the United States to the Essequibo Madre diversion near Juarez. And that was done before there were reservoirs, before Elephant Butte or any of the other reservoirs were built and whatnot. So ironically, way back then, they had the foresight to include climate and drought conditions as modifications to potential modifications to deliveries and whatnot. When the 1944 treaty came along, this was not done. And what we are really feel is needs to be adjusted in the treaty is the period of length of these treaty delivery periods. So the Rio Conchos is six tributaries in that watershed that deliver water from Mexico to the Rio Grande and the lower Rio Grande below the national park, the Big Bend. And so really what they have is a five-year period, but it's a sliding scale five-year period, which I would respectfully suggest is unfair, because the minute they have an extreme event or anything like that, they reset that five-year period. And so you end up with a delivery that would have been good for the entire 5 years, and now suddenly you're on the hook for a whole new delivery. And what we discovered in our climate analysis is that the real period is more like 8 years of drought, and that actually dry periods for the last few centuries, based on tree rings, have been anywhere from 12 to 43 years in length. And anything more than a decade is a mega drought, a decade or more. And so this is part of what's been going on there for a very long time. And the treaty really ought to reflect those conditions. In our second paper, if I may say that one of the other things that we've discovered is that there are these extreme wet events, and the Francisco Madera Reservoir, which is a small pass-through reservoir on the San Pedro River, which is a tributary to the Rio Conchos, has overflowed 26 times since it was built in the 1950s. And when you look at that aspect of it, what you end up seeing is that most of those are related to extreme events. And these extreme events include the enormous number of East Pacific hurricanes and tropical storms. We've already had four. There's been none in the Atlantic. And this year alone, we've already had four tropical storms / hurricanes in the East Pacific. So we're up to Dahlia, the number four. And so we're off and running, and it's increased in the East Pacific from about a dozen to more than 20 a year. So the sea surface temperatures are becoming warmer and more variable. The convergence zone is moving latitudinally up and down a lot more, and so on. So anyway, all these things are creating these extreme events and capturing some of that water, which is way more than, and in many cases, way more than 100% of the treaty delivery requirement, is really important. And I have other colleagues, such as Dr. Laura Norman, who's at the USGS in Tucson, who's been studying this throughout Arizona. She's also involved with some joint projects. Now they're looking at trying to capture some of this on some large ranches just outside of La Paz in Baja Sur, Mexico. So again, the cyclones that are coming through, the hurricanes, and they're trying to capture some of that water in some way or another. So anyway, a lot of people are doing it. We're doing it in the Central Valley. As you well know, it's become formal through laws and whatnot and permitting in the Central Valley. So they're protecting wetland areas, so you can't just divert the water anywhere and whatnot. So anyway, so there's a lot of people that are trying to do this, and it's not just in the U.S., and it's encouraging to see that people are seeing that's got to be a part of conjunctive use and sustainability.
Right. So the treaty, the 1944 Mexico Waters Treaty, it requires a transfer of 400 million cubic meters of water, which is about, a million cubic meter is about an acre foot of water. Yeah. But then there's this five-year period, so there are some constraints on that. And as you said, they reset the clock, which doesn't seem fair. I agree. So you have been focusing on that one paper was very comprehensive, describing a lot of the changes that have occurred in the basin. So the Rio Concho is the major source of water that Mexico delivers the water to the U.S., right? The Rio Concho. Right. And so in the Rio Concho, then there have been land use changes and expansion of agriculture, and then changes in the type of land use to more perennial crops, which we've seen in California too, probably pecan orchards and things like that.
Yep.
And then also population growth. So all of these things increasing water demand in the basin and hardening that water demand, which is difficult to deal with when you have a drought, and because you can just simply fallow the land and not grow the annual crop. So These are the same issues that you've been dealing with in the Central Valley.
They are. And the big difference is whether there will be limits on land use development, either in the Central Valley. There are some claims that maybe on the order of more than 800,000 acres of Central Valley has to be retired to bring it back into sustainability in some sense. So we'll see how that goes and whether they can capture more water and offset some of that demand. But land use and climate are the two big drivers of demand. And that's what we're seeing not only in Mexico, but in the Central Valley and a lot of other places as well.
Right. And some of the plots that you had in that paper, you show the increased economic value of those. So the economic value of these perennial, like pecans and almonds in California and these sorts of things, are much higher than traditional annual crops. So economics is the driver there for those sorts of land use change.
Yep. And they had record in the Mesilla Basin, that part of the Lower Rio Grande in New Mexico. During this last large drought, they had record yields of pecans in those areas. So they really are still able to sustain their profitability even through these intermediate-sized droughts, which is a challenge because how are they sustaining that at the same time as sustaining the resources and replenishing them?
And I think in California, the Central Valley, GA London, others have written reports and papers saying the economic impacts of drought has not been as great as they expected or anticipated, because I guess the water was moving up to the higher value users, and there were the markets in some of those irrigation districts like Arvin Edison and others. And so then those high-end users then could pay more for the water and maintain their perennial trees and stuff.
Right, right. And we've seen this in other places, unfortunately. And probably the bad example is Chile, and where they went to a complete free market on water. And the mining companies and larger agricultural entities bought up a lot of the water rights and whatnot, and it really became an issue. So there has to be some combination of a market and governance that kind of constrains things and assures some element of sustainability, and not just continued unbridled growth model, so to speak. And what we're seeing in the Central Valley, unfortunately, is that people are drilling wells deeper and deeper, and that's triggering a lot of the secondary bad effects that are outlined, the six deadly sins, as I call them, in Sigma. And that includes things like land subsidence and increased salinity and so on.
Right, right. And SGMA is the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act that was initiated in 2014 during your extreme drought. And in the Conscious Valley studies, then, you put a lot of emphasis in climate teleconnections and these drivers of wet and dry periods and interannual variability. And I think in one of the reports, the papers that I was looking at, you mentioned over a 70-year period, there were about almost 60 months of very wet or extreme wet conditions, and then about 18 months of extreme dry or high, based on SPI data. Yeah. So maybe you can describe that variability then. And then you mentioned that the reservoir was over-talked about 26 times since it was built. And if we can capture more of this flood water, then we could try to move towards more sustainable management.
That's really the key. And the fact that we know that these cycles really affect water management at a variety of different scales. And we actually kind of encapsulated that really you end up with climate cycles that are affecting annual operations, but then you also have climate cycles that are decadal and whatnot, and interannual to decadal, and that's operation development. Then there's multi-decadal, and there's multi-century. And we know that a lot of times developing projects, whether it's building a reservoir or a canal system or whatever, that a lot of times these things take a decade to occur. So we really have to be looking at multiple time periods to try to get a handle on how to not only change governance, but also to enhance the funding of these projects and to develop these projects and whatnot. And so that's a common driver. And that's what we're also doing that in the Central Valley. I'm involved with CV Salts, and we're looking at salinity and nutrient management there. And these things are going to take decades to get over. So you have to keep the climate context that these cycles are occurring in these different cycles, and whether it be the mega droughts. And a lot of this is, even down in the Rio Conchos, is being driven, believe it or not, by the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which is the temperature differences in the northern Pacific that drive the winter storms. And even though most of the rainfall in the Rio Conchos is during the monsoon, summer monsoon, it's still affected greatly by the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which is about 11 to 30 year cycles or several modes in the PDO. But that's a biggie.
Right, right. And many people are familiar with the El Nino Southern Oscillation, ENSO cycles, and that's maybe 3 to 7 years in El Nino and La Nina conditions, and if we expect it to be wet or dry in either of those. And so the Rio Conchos, I guess you mentioned maybe La Nina, wet conditions associated with La Nina in the Rio Conchos. And then you have this longer term cycle, the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, and then the conditions, whether it's positive or negative, impact. A longer-term impact. And what's really nice about your analysis is the extremely long timescale that you developed from the tree ring data. I mean, that is amazing. And so maybe you can describe a little bit how you linked the tree rings to El Nino conditions, and then were able to extend that back in time for a millennium almost, I think. Yeah.
We did several things. One thing to note is that of the 20 of these overflows, these reservoir overflows, were more than 100% of the 5-year treaty delivery. 8 occurred during La Nina, 6 in neutral conditions, and 11 during El Nino conditions. So we acknowledge that El Nino and ENSO is important, but it's maybe not one of the major drivers in these areas. So then we brought in the tree rings. It was really the folks at the Earth Lab at Lamont Doherty had these tree rings. And they weren't in the tree ring catalog. I was able to contact them. They shared those with us. And one was for Casas Grandes, which went back over 1,200 years, which is really amazing. And the Casas Grandes civilization is an amazing piece of indigenous history because they were one of the only pre-Columbian civilizations that had a water well. And so they were there for quite a while. We tried to relate that in that sense. So we, for the tree rings, what we did is we did the same thing that we do with other climate time series. We turn them into a cumulative departure. And that allows us to look at basically the first derivative of change. And then we do a frequency analysis of the residuals. We detrend that with a fourth order polynomial typically for long time periods, and then look at the residuals. What we're doing with the detrending is we're taking out partial larger cycles. And so we're just down to what's left in, from those larger cycles. And so we did that for the tree rings as well as all the other hydrologic time series. And then we also then tried to reconstruct historical ENSO events by looking at the categories of the ENSO event versus the width of tree rings. And we extrapolated that back through the 1,200 years of the Casas Grandes tree rings to look at the occurrence of ENSO. But what was also equally important, all that, is that we were also able to discover a group at the University of Utah, and I love to bring in other people's work because that's what really brings a lot of this together. And they discovered a cave full of rabbit bones just south of Tijuana. And they analyzed these rabbit bones and then correlated it with some lake sediments in Ecuador. And they had discovered that, in fact, there were no El Niños, there was no ENSO for over 5,000 years coming out of the last ice age. And so it's something that a lot of people like to think that it's something that's regular. It's not. It has other cycles in it. And it was non-existent for a very long time. So we see all these different elements of cycles that are occurring at decadal up to century and millennial timescales.
And that's amazing. And it's great because, I mean, the more data you can bring to bear on a problem,
right,
you increase your confidence in what you're thinking, the conceptual understanding of what's going on in the system. So that's wonderful. So basically, you're saying that there were no ENSO cycles for 5,000 years. So the last glacial was like about 10,000 years ago. So from 10,000 to 5,000 years, no evidence of ENSO cycles during that time. And then you mentioned Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which is a longer timescale, multi-decadal. And so do you have more wet events during a negative phase or a positive phase of the Pacific Decadal Oscillation? Or,
well, the positive is cooler, wetter. The negative is drier, warmer. And the thing that really creates these extreme events is when these various cycles, whether it be ENSO, PDO, and the big driver of drought in North America is the AMO, the Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation. And so when these are coming in and out of phase with each other, that's when you get these really extreme events. They contribute to the being more of these extreme events. And then combined with what's going on in the East Pacific in the ENSO 3-4 region. But yeah, so that's really what we see. And we see that a lot of those climate indices, we actually analyzed all those climate indices, which no one else had done that I was aware of, and found that there's all these other cycles that are multi-decadal cycles that occur in all of them. So they're all variable, and some of them are dancing together, and some of them, sometimes they're together, and sometimes they're not.
Right. And one of the things, in when you looked at the longer time scale, then I think you related some of that variability to changes in solar cycle. So maybe you can describe that a little bit, Randy.
Well, it was, again, bringing collaborators together. So I had this, the tree ring indices and the cumulative departure from Casas Grandes, and I shared it with Dr. Chris Eastow, who's now retired at the University of Arizona. And he writes me back, he goes, "My God, Randy, that's the millennial solar oscillation, which is 1,470 years. And he had already done a bunch of work looking at carbon-14 of tree rings and whatnot. And so we brought him in on our analysis, and that's in our first paper. And he was able to show that quite a bit of correlation with the carbon 14 data that he had meticulously analyzed from tree rings from North America and whatnot. And I had other people say we're one of the first people to analyze and see this anywhere outside of ice cores. They see it in ice cores. But so, this millennial solar oscillation is a big deal. And it was really thanks to the collaboration with Chris Isto that allowed us to bring in this additional element of what's going on. A lot of the climate people will say that's not important because it's not enough of an oscillation to perturbation. But when you look at things like tree rings and whatnot that show these oscillations over these multi-century periods, I would probably beg to differ.
And so you had tree rings then from Casas Grande in the Conchos. Are there other tree rings in Mexico in that region, or was that the only?
We looked at three different ones, the others had long periods, but not quite as long as the Casas Grandes.
And were they consistent? Was there good consistency?
Yes. They were. There are some minor modifications, and a lot of that probably is microclimates and rain shadows from some of the large mountain ranges there and whatnot. So and everything, but it also is very coincident with the work that was done at the University of Arizona Tree Ring Lab, and they looked at bristlecone pine and ponderosa pine in Arizona, and they saw very similar cycles in their work. And that was another thing that we collaborated with them as well.
And so what actual trees were you looking at in Casas Grandes or in these other, what type of trees were they?
They're largely pine trees. And when they do a tree ring index, my understanding is it's a set of trees. It's not just one tree.
Right.
And so they're reconstructing from a group of trees that live in a certain area, whatnot. But a lot of these trees can live pretty long.
Right. Well, it's wonderful to have this long-term context, because a lot of hydrologists these days, it seems like they focus a lot on remote sensing data, satellite data. So 20 years ago is when the world started. You know? And so really important to have longer-term context to understand systems. And then, as you mentioned earlier on, hurricanes and tropical storms from the Pacific and the Atlantic can also play an important role in these wet periods. And now, when you mention hurricanes from the East Pacific, are they related at all to the atmospheric rivers that Mike Dettinger talks about? Or
they're actually not. But if you look at the recent studies that Marty Ralph and Mike Dettinger and others have been doing, what they're suggesting in their studies is that there will probably be more of those, and that they'll have a broader swath of latitude that they occur. So we've actually, most recently, we've even had a few way down here. So, I mean, they can hit anywhere from Nome, Alaska, all the way down to northern Baja at this point. And they're based on one of Mike's more recent papers, he did suggest that this was going to be more and more of a player in all of this, but it's just a matter of how. It used to be called the Pineapple Express, and it was really the jet stream kind of extreme coming off the Hawaii High in many ways, but it's moved around quite a bit more, and there's more of these. So the simple answer is yes, I think they'll play into this, but that's occurring above the convergence zone, which is really where the hurricanes and tropical storms are occurring. So that convergence zone is moving north now. It was way down near Costa Rica a few months ago, and now it's almost back up where it typically is this time of year around Acapulco and whatnot. So it moves back and forth.
Right. And you mentioned that the rain from these events is more in the winter, of course in the winter, but most of the rain in the Conchos, Rio Conchos, is summer monsoon, just like Arizona those places. So we talk a lot about the river flow, the reservoirs. You have three reservoirs, I think, in the Rio Conchos and how they function. But then there's also the groundwater. When we talk about one water, what you're referring to, I guess, is conjunctive management of surface water and groundwater. So groundwater is very important, and transboundary aquifers play a critical role in the water resources management. So maybe you can describe a little bit about the relative importance of surface water and groundwater. Are the people irrigating mostly with surface water? Do they shift to groundwater during drought, or what happens?
It is. And even in the Rio Conchos during, I think it was the drought of 94, they drilled hundreds of wells. And so this can happen very quickly. And people are, they don't get the monsoons, they don't get the surface water that they need. There was also some conflicts with the farmers because the government wasn't releasing water from some of the reservoirs during one of the dry periods and whatnot. So there have definitely been some issues in the Rio Conchos. This is obviously the whole unfortunate issue that triggered the Supreme Court lawsuit over the Rio Grande and in the Mesilla Basin and New Mexico and Texas, that additional pumpage and more groundwater pumpage was starting to interfere with the deliveries under the operating agreement between the various irrigation districts there. And that caused conflict, legal conflict, which is still yet not resolved. But so this is a really common thing. And we're seeing that. We just saw that in the Central Valley. People are drilling wells left and right during these drought periods and whatnot. So they're trying to compensate for the lack of surface water by extracting more and more groundwater. The problem is that a lot of that groundwater is anywhere from thousands to tens of thousands of years old. So they're really mining old groundwater and causing these secondary bad effects like land subsidence and whatnot as well. So we're just seeing that in a variety of places, and it's certainly an issue. We'll see what happens. There are definitely some changes in governance that have to occur in Mexico as well as in the United States to make that more feasible in many ways. So we'll see if people are able to do that.
I mean, in one way, it's helpful to use both surface water and groundwater. And in the Central Valley, during wet periods, you get those deliveries from the north to the Central Valley. And so they irrigate mostly with surface water. And then during a drought, those deliveries are shut off. You've got the Delta smelt endangered species. And so then they turn to groundwater. So it seesaws between about 70% surface water, I think, during wet periods to 70% groundwater. But if they didn't use the surface water during the wet periods, you'd be in a lot worse trouble. And of course, they built all those aqueducts in the 50s, 60s to bring the water from the humid region in the north to the south. So, and everywhere we're seeing this, I think Cape Town during the drought in the city, they were all drilling wells. Sao Paulo during drought, they all drilling wells. So, I mean, it's there, it's ubiquitous. And so it's the go-to if you don't have the surface water. But the problem is it's not really monitored or managed or things like that. So it's a bit, if it was managed better, then maybe we could use it as a resource more effectively or have it more sustainable.
Well, and combined with maybe, if possible, limiting the amount of expansion of land use, because that's the other driver. It's not just drought. It's the expansion of agriculture in the areas that may or may not really be warranted in some sense. But that's a governance issue. That's part of the resource management.
Right. And of course, a lot of these regions, they want that economic development and tax base and everything. Yeah. And so there are a lot of conflicting things going on. So it's difficult to constrain. So Randy, you have made huge contributions to ModFlow, which is like the most widely used groundwater model. And now maybe we shouldn't be calling it groundwater because you've got the one water version. So maybe you can describe a little bit how that has evolved. You were involved in developing the farm packages and all of that. And then the conjunctive use. It would be great to hear how that came to pass and how it evolved over time.
Well, it all started at the University of Arizona, and one of Tom Maddock's students, Wolfgang Schmidt, was finishing his PhD dissertation there, and they were applying it to the lower Rio Grande and Mesilla Basin in New Mexico. And I, as an alumni of U of A as well, I was back there and interacting with Tom Maddock and Wolfgang and whatnot, and they were showing me what they were doing. I said, oh my God. This is what we need for the Central Valley. And the key was that what we were trying to do is to create a more integrated hydrologic model. So it wasn't just groundwater and maybe some minor interaction with surface water flows and whatnot. But now we wanted to actually build a supply and demand framework where the various components of the model could talk to each other and say, hey, I need this amount of water over here, or I don't have enough water, so I'm going to have to deficit irrigate, or a variety of other reactions or behaviors where they were coupled together. So we're looking at land use including land use through the farm process, which is what Wolfgang developed for his PhD dissertation back in 2004, and then finally adding in climate, which came in with that. And then as we got into the whole Rio Grande issues and whatnot, and trying to help them evaluate, the Bureau of Reclamation did an environmental impact statement to show that their operations were feasible into the future. And Ian Ferguson, who's the technical services group in Denver, helped develop reservoir operations. So now we have reservoir operations. So we're coupling all these different things together into what we now call one water version of ModFlow. And it really allows us to look at drain return flows and a variety of other things. And they all talk to each other and whatnot in a supply and demand context. So that's what we think is meaningful about it. There are a few other codes that kind of do similar stuff, but we would argue that ours is probably one of the more complete ones and was rated by the World Bank as one of the best conjunctive use simulators as well.
Right. And plus, it's developed through the government, and so it's available to anybody.
It's free. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Right. Yeah. I mean, you may have to pay for a user interface or whatever, but essentially, I mean, when you compare some what they charge for using some models, it's really nice to have a free product that anybody can use. And it's great then that you include the linkages and feedbacks between these different, because sometimes somebody will ask me to write something about groundwater, and I say, I can't write about groundwater without considering surface water. Yep. And so I think we've moved beyond these silos of groundwater stuff. We've regulated them separately for a long time. We're still, in many places, we still are. But we need to acknowledge that they're connected and understand how they're connected and those dynamics. And so do you feel like when people use one water, then that they develop a lot deeper insights into how the system works? And
well, not only better insights into how it works, but also it gives them the ability to try out different mitigation or adaptation strategies. So if they're overexploiting a resource, what can they do to compensate for that, whether it be reduced land use or additional replenishment and or a variety of other activities? And that's really what I think has been really helpful in many of the applications of one water in various places. And it's being used in California a lot. We have it being used in a lot of other parts of the world. And it really does allow people to say, well, okay, this is going to be over exploitation. What can we do to compensate for that? And how can we get other forms of that, of water that maybe weren't captured or weren't being used or reused, and see how they can reduce the inequity between supply and demand.
Right, right. And another tool that you developed a while back was the hydroclimate toolkit. And I guess that is to help people understand how to analyze these climate indices and teleconnections and things like that. So that's very valuable also. So if you're running ModFlow then and considering these climate drivers and stuff, then you get a feel for the interannual to decadal variability. And oftentimes I think it's just the psychology of it. When you're in a drought, you think you're never going to get out of it. And when you're in a wet period, you think you're never going to get into a drought. But it's understanding that it's managing these extremes is really the challenge.
Yep. And being able to have a simulator that can allow you to have those components and talk, those components are talking to each other, really essential in being able to look at what the transition is from one setting too much to too little. And we don't ever have average conditions in California. It's either one or the other. And it's so that's becomes even more critical in that context.
And I think maybe, and you talk about different adaptation strategies. I mean, in the past, when you had annual crops, if you were in a drought, you could fallow and you could see that. And you would see that, I guess, with the farm package, that there would be a lot of fallowing going on, and you could see it from the satellite data. But then when you hardened that demand with orchards and nut trees and things like that, then that option goes away. So this conjunctive management is really important. And I mean, when you have a wet period, then, I mean, you mentioned those reservoirs in Rio Conchas overtopping. If you could capture that water then and get it into the aquifer so it's there for the next drought, or it could replenish some depletion that you had. And it seems like we have plenty of depleted aquifers. I mean, Lenny Conacom estimated there was about 1,000 cubic kilometers of storage space created by groundwater depletion in the U.S.
Right.
So that's a big reservoir that is there. And I guess you're doing that in California with flood managed aquifer recharge and ag managed aquifer recharge and all of these different things. So I think that's great.
It's a start, and we'll see how it shakes out. There's a lot of devils in the details. Replenishing waters that are of the different chemistry can be challenging. And we saw that, and the classic example of that is what happened in Tucson, Arizona. They were pumping too much in down the southern part of the basin. I did the modeling for that as well, and I can tell you that then they went to some wells in the northern part of the basin, and this woman had bequeathed her land on the Tankaverde Wash as a wildlife refuge and whatnot, all the mesquite. But that pumping started to kill all the mesquite and the habitat for these birds and whatnot. And so they had to stop that. And then they brought in the Central Arizona Project water, but it had a different chemistry. And then their ozonation and whatnot dropped the pH. Anyway, make a short story long, they started delivering water that was chemically incompatible. It ruined people's houses and their dishwashers, and it was a big... Anyway, so you have to be careful, and there's a lot of different facets to replacement sources and replenishment and how you do these things and whatnot. So I think that's what we're going to see more and more of. And we've seen that for years. I know you probably know that, but when people have multi-aquifer wells that are screened over different aquifers, the upper ones are oxidized and calcium carbonate waters, and the lower ones might be reduced waters, and causes a lot of well screen incrustation and whatnot. So there's a lot of secondary effects to these situations where they're trying to create other sources and then blend the sources together.
Yeah, I think in Tucson there were a lot of people walking around with pink shirts for a while because of the iron. But I mean, so we were doing an analysis, and you saw that for the Colorado and in Arizona, and then some folks saying that the mantra is pump and replenish there. So they keep pumping the groundwater, and then now they recharge the aquifers with the Central Arizona Project water through these spreading basins. And also with the surface water irrigation, when they switched from groundwater to surface water irrigation, I mean, everybody... Sometimes I think people are naive and they just think, well, managed aquifer recharge, intentional, but then they don't consider if they're irrigating with surface water versus groundwater. I mean, if you're irrigating with surface water, it could be similar to managed aquifer recharge if it's not very efficient. Right. But they make a big deal about intentional. But I mean, the aquifer doesn't know whether you're intending it or not. It just happens.
Right. Well, and that was the big discovery when we did the original Central Valley hydrologic model and whatnot, and even with the more recent version, is that really inefficient irrigation. There's some people in European scientific communities and whatnot that think, oh no, this all has to be dreadfully efficient. And actually, the inefficiency is wonderful. And inefficient irrigation is one of the biggest elements of recharge in the Central Valley, as an example of that. So I've always been an advocate that some of that's probably okay.
Right. Well, I mean, your colleague, Claudia Font, she said inefficient surface water irrigation and extremely efficient drip when you're using groundwater. And the Murray-Darling Basin, when they spent so much billions, $6 or $7 billion on precision ag, lining canals and everything, and then didn't take into account the fact that they were losing that recharge. Was impacting surface water. So it's all connected. And so that's what I love about your work is one water and bringing mod flow forward and considering conjunctive management of surface water and groundwater. And we were doing, I mean, Helen Dahlke at UC Davis did a study many years ago with Coaches and Dahlke, that paper on how much extreme flows could the high magnitude flows could they capture in California for recharge greater than 90th percentile. And we did a similar analysis in Texas. In some years, it was equivalent to the water use in the state, if you could capture it. But the challenge is capturing it. So I think we're becoming much more aware of these things. And I think different types of recharge projects will help to manage that.
Well, that's something that some of my colleagues like Laura Norman at the USGS has looked at quite a bit. And some of the stuff is pretty low tech. It's installing gabions and things like that in stream channels, rubber dams, other things like that, that can be temporary redirection of water. And that's being done in a variety of locations. And so there's a lot of creative, some of it's high tech and some of it's low tech, and it also helps with sediment erosion too, things like gabions and whatnot. So you can do a lot of different things to help redirect those extreme events and get some of that water infiltrating into adjacent floodplain areas that are also permeable and connected.
Right, right. And I think even some studies in Kenya, sand dams and stuff like that. And the big problem with these increasing extremes is that you get a lot of erosion and sediment movement and stuff like that. So having these things in place will help with the recharging aquifers and taking advantage of that extreme flows. And another thing that I liked about your analysis, that you get to the basics, which is like, what can we do? Reduce demand, increase supplies, store, transport, all of these fundamental things. And then you can test a lot of these then with your modeling analysis to see how best to adapt.
That's the key. And you have some ideas, we can try it out. And what we typically try to do with these models is that which everyone does, you calibrate it on the historical period, but that really allows you to develop skill with the model so that when you do these projections, either whether they're climate projections or adaptation mitigation scenarios or whatever, that you have some skill in how things are being behaved. And the ability to estimate pumpage, which is what we do with the farm process for agriculture, is really very useful because we can then have an idea of what demand might look like and how it might change under different scenarios of the future.
Right, right. So that's essential then if you're going to try to adapt. And so since you worked in a lot in California, in many places, of course, in the Southwest, but also in Mexico, do you see that then the real conscious then that they may be able to use more managed aquifer recharge or maybe more surface water irrigation during these to take advantage of those high flows when they overtop? And what do you think is the predictive skill for estimating when you might get those reservoirs overtopping, considering the climate indices?
That's a great question. And I've had many a water district say, hey, if we knew a year in advance what's coming, they'd let out water earlier. They would create more storage space and whatnot. And in some places, I was working in Taiwan, and they have several reservoirs there, and they actually dredge them 24 hours, 24/7. They're constantly dredging because the cyclones come through and create so much sediment inflow as well as water that they are constantly having to adapt to these extreme conditions. So there's been some amazing examples of this in different places. But the idea of being able to have some kind of prediction, whether it's through the frequency analysis, and we show that in the second paper, that even a year or two into the future, it looks like we can show that. And actually, Mike Dettinger and I showed that way back when on our Ventura stuff back in 2004. So we were already looking at that possibility. So you can get a little bit of a head start on some of this as to what, just based on the historical cycles. They're not 100% reliable, but they would give you a good indicator. So that's something that we've advocated for a long time to use.
And I guess the Corps of Engineers is moving in that direction with their forecast-informed reservoir operations,
right,
where you
right.
do have good forecast skills, then they can change the management rules for the reservoirs, which were developed maybe decades ago under a different climate cycle or whatever. So
right.
it's nice to see these people adapting to these things and trying to manage the water resources to move towards more sustainable management. And one of the things we say, reduce demand, increase supplies, and you said land use, maybe a cap on the agricultural expansion. But you also mentioned there were some breweries that are looking for permits in Mexico and Canagua denied.
They did in Mexicali, yes. And they do consume quite a bit of water. But that's just another example of non-agricultural water uses, whether it's the maquiladoras, breweries. In the Central Valley, we have meat processing, poultry, and vineyard processing of waters that all are creating these additional consumptions of water and additional waste streams that have to be dealt with and whatnot. So that's been a big issue in many settings. It's not just agriculture.
Right. And one of the terms that you mentioned when we chatted recently was wild water. And I had never heard that term. And so I think it's really cool. So this is water that runs off before it reaches the stream, before it becomes a water of the U.S.?
Where before it becomes what is sometimes called project water. And so when you have the Bureau of Reclamation in particular, it would be the Central Valley, northern part of the Central Valley, or the Colorado or the Rio Grande, they have reservoirs, and those are being operated by the Bureau of Reclamation. And so any water that's coming out of those is part of agreements of distribution, and there may be also water rights embedded in those and whatnot. And so that's project water. But water that's coming in during these extreme events off the peripheral watersheds, before it hits the main river, it's not project water. And so it's been termed wild water.
Right, right. So if we can improve our management of wild water, then I think that would help us become more sustainable.
And people are looking at ways of capturing that. So that's a common thing.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Randy. Our guest today is Randy Hansen. He's president of One Water Hydrologic and previously worked at the U.S. Geological Survey. I really appreciate your time, and we will provide highlights of this discussion and links to various papers and reports and modeling tools and things like that the listeners can evaluate after they listen to the podcast.
Thank you so much. And just one last plug. Look for my new book with Richard Evans from Jacobs in Melbourne, Australia. We're the co-authors of the new John Cherry book on conjunctive water management, and that should be coming out in the next month or so. So it has model exercises in it as well. So hopefully that'll be of interest to many practitioners.
Well, that's wonderful. I commend you for taking the time to do that. I can barely manage to do a tweet, not to mind a book. But thank you so much, Randy.
All right. Thank you so much, Bridget, for having me, and look forward to seeing more of your podcasts.